Recording in progress.
Well, good evening. I'll call to order this regular session of the City Council of the City of Atascadero. And I would ask for first to let you know that we all five of us are here. Councilmember Funk's camera, we're still getting that to work, but we want you to know that she is here and present with us. And with that,
this regular session.
Oh, I think that was a little feedback. All right, we will move on to the Pledge of Allegiance. Councilmember Darris, would you lead us?
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you. Roll call, please.
Yes, Councilmember Borbo.
Here.
Councilmember Darris.
Here.
Councilmember Fung.
Here.
Mayor Pro Tem Newsom.
Here.
Mayor Moreno.
Here.
All present.
Thank you. And we do want to welcome Dylan sitting in for our City Clerk Laura tonight. Dylan's been with us for several months now, and it's exciting to have you at your first council meeting, so welcome. Now, if you're attending the meeting in person, whether you're listening on KPRL, Channel 20, you're on the Zoom webinar, we welcome you tonight. And if you would like to speak by phone on for public comment, you can call. Hold on a second. Luke, I'm getting a little bit of feedback. Is there? Okay, I'm going to bring this a little further away. Hopefully you can all still hear me, but we don't get that echo. If you would like to call in during the time set aside for community forum or during any of the items that are on our agenda tonight, you can call 669-900-6833. That is 669-900-6833. And then when you call in, you'll be asked for a meeting ID number, and that meeting ID is 889-2347-9018. That's 889-2347-9018. When you call in, please let us know which item that you would like to speak on. And if you download the agenda off of the website at Atascadero. Sorry, I looked at Terry and I'm thinking tourism. Atascadero.org. You will find the agenda and all of that information is on the very front page. Let's see, can I get a motion to approve the agenda?
I'll so move.
I'll second.
We have a motion by Councilmember Borbo, a second by Councilmember Funk, and we will waive the reading in full of all ordinances appearing on this agenda, and the titles of the ordinances will be read aloud by the city clerk at the first reading after the motion and before the council votes. Roll call, please.
Councilmember Borbo?
Yes.
Councilmember Darris?
Yes.
Councilmember Funk?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Newsom?
Yes.
Mayor Moreno?
Yes, ma'am. Yes, motion. Sir. Sorry, I'm so used to yes, ma'am. Yes, sir.
Motion passes.
Thank you. And let's see. I have a city attorney report. We did have closed session last meeting, correct?
No, I don't believe you did.
We're just putting it on there as a... Okay,
yes.
Got it.
And Mayor, while we're talking city attorney, I did want to introduce Brian Hamlet. He is with Burke Williams Sorensen, and he is filling in for our city attorney tonight, so he will be our city attorney.
Wonderful.
But we did not have a closed session, so okay. There is nothing to report.
Thank you. I saw none, and then I saw the city attorney will report, so all right. Thank you for clarifying. Next, we're on to presentations. We have a proclamation declaring July as Parks Make Life Better Month, and I have asked our former Parks Commissioner and the parent of a young lady, Mayor Pro Tem Newsom, to deliver that.
Little did you know that young lady wanted to come to session tonight. Didn't understand why she couldn't just sit there quietly. The proclamation, whereas Parks and Recreation promotes physical, emotional, and mental health and wellness through organized and self-directed fitness, play, and activity. And whereas Parks and Recreation supports the economic vitality of communities by providing frontline jobs, childcare for the essential workforce, and promoting community revitalization. And whereas Parks and Recreation creates memorable experiences through engaging virtual and physical distanced programs, dynamic online events, and new learning opportunities designed to keep families active while stay-at-home orders are in place and beyond. And whereas parks and recreation fosters social cohesiveness in Atascadero by celebrating diversity, providing spaces to come together peacefully, modeling compassion, promoting social equity, connecting social networks, and ensuring all people have access to these benefits. And whereas parks and recreation supports human development and endless learning opportunities that foster social, intellectual, physical, and emotional growth in people of all ages and abilities. Whereas parks and recreation strengthens community identity by providing facilities and services that reflect and celebrate community character, heritage, culture, history, aesthetics, and landscape. And whereas parks and recreation facilitates community problem and issue resolution by providing safe spaces to come together peacefully and serving as key points of service, helping our community heal both physically and emotionally. And whereas parks and recreation sustains and stewards our natural resources by protecting habitats and open space, connecting people to nature, and promoting the ecological function of parkland. And whereas parks and recreation supports a safe, vibrant, attractive, progressive community that makes life better through positive alternatives offered in our recreational opportunities. And whereas parks and recreation remains vital and innovative in providing vital services to our community of Atascadero through local, national, or global emergencies, all while adhering to guidelines set forth by governing agencies. And now, therefore, on behalf of the City Council and recognition of the importance of access to local parks, recreation, trails, open space, and facilities for all Atascadero citizens, I hereby proclaim the month of July 2022 as Parks Make Life Better Month.
Jennifer, Fanny, would you like to join us and say a few words? And then we'd be happy to come take a picture with you.
Is on. Okay, thank you very much for that. California Park and Recreation Society is a statewide group that covers what we do here locally, every agency across the state. We have 15 different districts for CPRS is what we call it. Our district is District 8. It goes from Paso Robles down to Simi Valley, and I am the president this year of District 8. So the city of Atascadero accepting this proclamation and making it official is a big deal. It kind of sets a precedence for our other agencies in our district and statewide. So we did have a slideshow put together of all the cities and all the different districts where the Parks Make Life Better Month and, you know, just different programs and each city took a different piece of that resolution proclamation and said why that was important, and these pictures are just a small piece of what we do here in the city of Atascadero. So thank you all council members and mayor for making that proclamation happen. I appreciate it.
Well, and thank you for your commitment and dedication to just serving the residents of Atascadero so well through the wonderful park system that we have and all that you do. Thank you.
Thank you.
Would you like to do a picture?
Of
or
course.
Are you kind of like,
yeah,
okay.
Oh, yeah.
Let's do it. Of course, Terry's like, we're doing a picture. right. Always like to have a proclamation and celebrate all the things going so well. We're on to our consent calendar. Consent calendar contains items that are considered routine and not controversial by city staff and can generally be passed in one motion unless there is a member of the council or the public wishing to pull an item. So I will look to my council members. Anyone wishing to? Seeing none, I will go to anyone here in the audience, public, I should say, here in the public. Anyone, if you're on the webinar, those of you, anyone wants to pull an item, you can go ahead and raise your hand. Is there anyone on the phone, Luke? No, okay. Seeing none, I'll ask for a motion.
I move approval of the consent calendar.
I'll second.
A motion by Councilmember Funk, a second by Mayor Pro Tem Newsom. Roll call, please.
Councilmember Borbo.
Yes.
Councilmember Darris.
Yes.
Councilmember Funk.
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Newsom.
Yes.
Mayor Moreno.
Yes, sir.
Motion passes.
Thank you. We are on to updates from the city manager. Ms. Rickard.
Thank you, Mayor. I wanted to remind everybody that the third of our Farmers Market Summer Sizzle events will be held tomorrow, Wednesday, July 13th, from 3 to 6 p.m., right here in the Sunken Gardens. Each Summer Sizzle includes live music, a featured chef providing food samples, and a complimentary recipe that includes ingredients that can be purchased from the farmers at the market. At tomorrow's event, everyone can enjoy great food and recipes provided by Colony Market and Deli, along with musical entertainment by Tennessee Jimmy. You'll be able to enjoy cider and wine tasting by Bristol Cider's House and Lone Madrone Winery, and those will also be available for purchase. In addition, Hamley Lavender Farm and Irish Oaks Mercantile will be on hand to help promote Slo County Farm Trail's second annual Open Farm Days, which is happening this coming weekend. We thank all of the wonderful local chefs, musicians, and beverage vendors for participating in our annual Farmers Market Summer Sizzles series. Boy, that's hard to say, Terry, sorry. I do want to remind everybody that next Wednesday, while we will not have a Summer Sizzle series event, we will still be having Farmers Market from 3 to 6 p.m. The Summer Sizzle series will pick up again after the fair is over, but you can still get all of the great vegetables and products and all the wonderful thing. The fruit right now is incredible. Oh, my gosh. I love the peaches. So, anyway, 3 to 6 every Wednesday right here in the downtown Sunken Gardens. We have another event, which is also delicious, one of my favorites, Ice Cream Zoofari. So everyone can come cool down at the Charles Paddock Zoo this Saturday, July 16th from 5:30 to 8 p.m. at Ice Cream Zoofari. It's a relaxing, enjoyable evening and that's in store for the whole family with live music, fun activities, a great variety of all-you-can-eat cool treats, and our wonderful collection of zoo animals from around the world. Your ticket for Ice Cream Zoofari includes admission to the zoo, along with, again, all-you-can-eat ice cream. Way more than you can eat
could you ice say cream. That, could you say that again? Is it two servings?
I know. there are some people that look a little green by the end of the night. Because you go, oh, I just want to try this one. But it's a lot of fun. It's great to see the animals at night. It's a little bit cooler. Some of the animals are a little bit more active. And it's just a fun evening for all. And we want to thank our sponsors. Ice Cream Zoofari is presented by Pure Pediatric Dentistry. They've been doing this for years. And it's also sponsored by Atascadero Rotary Club and New Times. And we appreciate all their sponsorship that help bring these wonderful events to the community. And speaking of wonderful events, we have Saturdays in the Park Summer Concert Series. So there won't be a concert in the park this Saturday, July 16th, due to Ice Cream Zoofari. Too many people in the park. We want to try and make that. So we'll skip 1 week, and our Summer Concert Series will continue on Saturday, July 23rd, beginning at 6:30 p.m., at the Atascadero Lake Bandstand with some California feel-good rock and roll music by Ghost Monster. Plus, Paradise Shaved Ice and Mary's Cuisine will be selling delicious concert fare, including shaved ice, tacos, burritos, and more.
And all of our concerts are free to attend, and everyone should bring a blanket or a low back chair and the entire family to enjoy these wonderful evenings here in Atascadero. The great concert evenings are made possible by our sponsors, which include Grigor and Alice Jones, Perry's Personal and Gift, Remax Success, Waste Management, Golden One Credit Union, and Stove and Spa Center. Again, if you see one of our sponsors or you visit them, please thank them. Without them, we couldn't do these events. So we sincerely thank all of our sponsors for their support. We hope our community enjoys some of these events. I know I do. And if you have or are looking for more information about city events, you can always go to visitatascadero.com. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions council may have.
Thank you. Yes, my husband and I went to the concert on Saturday, and I found out I'm very rusty in dancing after these last 2 years. So thank goodness Dancing with Our Stars is coming up, and I can get those skills honed again. We'll see. Any questions of staff? Seeing none. All right. We will move on to community forum. Community forum is a portion of the meeting that's reserved for persons who would like to address the council on an item that is not on our agenda this evening, but over which we have jurisdiction. Speakers are limited to 3 minutes, and we give a total of 30 minutes for community forum. We do ask that you state your name for the record, and typically any item that's brought up, we might be able to triage a quick answer, but it doesn't become a topic of conversation this evening. So with that, I will go ahead, and anybody here that would like to speak, please come to the podium, and if you are on the webinar, go ahead and raise your hand. And Luke, do we have anyone on the phone at all? No one on the phone. Okay. So I'm not seeing anyone, so if you're waiting to see who else goes, the time is now. Anyone in the webinar, go ahead and raise your hand. Anyone here wishing to speak? Not seeing anyone. All right, going once, going twice. All right, we will close community forum. We started at 6:18, and because nobody has spoken and we still have 29 minutes left of community forum, if anyone wants to speak between now and 6:48, go ahead and, you know, raise your hand or let us know, and we will let you come speak at the earliest opportunity, which will be after the next item that we discuss. All right. We are now on to our one management report that we have, and that is our Objective Design Standards Project. And this is our Community Development Director, Mr. Phil Dunsmore.
Thank you, Mayor. Good evening, Council. Well, it's been a couple of years that we've been thinking about bringing this forward to the community and talking about objective design standards. It stems from one of the policies in our recently adopted housing element, and that is to adopt objective design standards that really help strengthen our local control over the design of future multifamily and mixed-use projects. Since there's been a lot of new state housing laws that really require that we have a streamlined process, that we have a lot of things that are by right, it's now time for us to be able to adopt some local standards so we can have some local expectations and continue to protect our neighborhoods and to really have quality design. Now, recently we did get some grants that really support this effort along with a series of other efforts. We've utilized the grant to hire a consultant to help us with this endeavor. And tonight, Genevieve from MIG is gonna present to you an introduction of objective design standards, what they are, why we're doing this, and we're going to try and get some community input. And this is a starting point tonight. So this is a point where we're going to begin this process, begin this discussion, make sure we're all on the same page, get your feedback tonight, and continue this on as we continue to get more community feedback so we can start developing these objective design standards. So with no further ado, I'd like to... if we can, I'm going to IT now, if we can bring on our consultant, Genevieve, we can start that presentation, and then from that, I'd be happy to answer your questions. And welcome, Genevieve. Thank you.
Good evening. Thank you, Phil, and good evening, Mayor Pro Tem, and Council, and members of the public. I'm Genevieve Scherer with MIG, and I'm happy to be here tonight to start to have this discussion with you about objective design standards. And just want to confirm that you can see my screen right now. Yep, I see it on Luke's. Okay, great. So tonight I'd like to start with just a bit of a project overview, really just frame why we're doing this, talk a little bit about what we've heard to date, and then really dive deep a little bit into what are objective design standards, why do we need them, what do they mean, and then touch on the next steps anticipated in the process. We have two key discussion items that we'd like input from decision makers and the public tonight, but I'll run through the entire presentation so that you have all the information before we loop back to those two discussion items. So to start with a project overview, the 2020 housing element update really sets a course for the next 8 years. And it includes a lot of different implementation items. And as Phil mentioned, one of those is pertaining to objective design standards. A lot of the requirements in the housing element are triggered by state law, as is this project. The housing element also included a program to consider adopting small lot subdivision standards. Small lot subdivisions are often called planned unit developments or planned developments, PUDs or PDs, or kind of cluster developments of single family homes on one previously existing parcel. The small lot subdivision portion of the project is going to dovetail with the objective design standards portion of the project, and it's being aligned with other work on the general plan update at the same time. So back to that state law compliance part, SB 330, there's some legislative alphabet soup about SBs and ABs. I think they're all SBs, actually. SB 330, that was known as the Housing Crisis Act, and that amended the Housing Accountability Act. That law is really the crux of why we're doing the objective design standards. This law says that local governments can't disapprove or reduce the density of multifamily or mixed-use projects that comply with objective general plan zoning and subdivision standards and criteria. So SB 35 is kind of a narrower application of that. That's it sets up a new system where projects that meet very particular criteria can go through a ministerial process. A lot of those criteria can be somewhat difficult to meet. So throughout the state, there hasn't been that many SB 35 applications. So we're really focusing on SB 330, which is going to apply to everything, but also needing to accommodate that process for the potential SB 35 projects as well. There is also SB 9, which I'm sure you've also heard of. And that's another new law that requires cities to allow duplexes and lot splits on single family lots. So the intent of all of these laws was really to streamline housing development and really kind of reduce some of the local discretion that happens in the review process, where a project could be denied based on non-objective criteria. And the goal of all of this statewide legislation is really coming out of, you know, the legislative intent around the housing crisis, while still providing a pathway for jurisdictions to have tailored development design standards to suit the local community. And that's where those objective design standards come in. And I'll go into more detail about what's objective versus subjective a little bit in the process. But first, I wanted to talk a little bit about what we've heard to date and how we're kind of creating a lens through a few different key project goals that we think are guiding the process. So the first, last year we talked to council members and some key users of the zoning ordinance, including staff, fire, and some architects and developers, to understand how does the code work, what are the key issues that should frame the process from the decision maker's perspective, as well as what are the existing perspectives on the city zoning ordinance and how it's working today. So much of the discussion that we had with stakeholders hinged on the development standards that we could consider that will foster that effective design character in Atascadero. And these, you know, kind of ran the gamut. Density was discussed, flexibility with regard to density was discussed. Of course, parking always comes up as a key consideration as well. Fire access really can determine some ways that projects are designed and needs to kind of be considered up front. The need for high quality open space came up. Lot coverage requirements were identified as potentially a constraint to meeting allowed densities on certain sites. Building articulation and lighting that supports good design were noted as priorities. The consideration that topography in Atascadero really does create challenges and also potentially some benefits is, you know, some creative ways can be thought through the topography, but really considering the fact that we've got a lot of topography that we need to consider, and that needs to be addressed in the objective design standards. Also, the need to be attentive to sight lines and privacy in the standards, especially into bedrooms and in consideration of that topography. Trash enclosures, an often forgotten component of design that can be tricky to get right. Identifying more tailored standards for mixed use development, sewer access as a potential constraint, and sustainability to encourage more native and low water landscaping. All of these ideas were discussed and brought up. Discussions regarding the small lot subdivisions focused on ways to really streamline the existing process, which does right now require a zone change to a PD. Certain considerations with regard to development standards pertain to lot size, lot coverage, parking, and open space in particular. The design review process was also discussed, including ways that review could be streamlined through the implementation of objective design standards. And participants also discussed some high priority areas where special care should be taken when thinking about the design standards for that area, including downtown, along El Camino, along Highway 41, and the Del Rio area. And participants also discussed affordability by design and different ways to support that more of this product type. So based on this input and drawing from work completed on the housing element and best practices, the consultant team and staff identified, six key project goals. These are kind of design goals, kind of project goals, things that we're thinking at this point at the outset of the project here early on should help us frame our thinking as we dive into crafting these objective design standards. The first of which is tradition, the first key goal. And tradition here, our interpretation is that Atascadero is really unique and has a strong history that's reflected in the local architecture and city design. The town's original colony formation and history are really important to consider and foundational for design inspiration, and should be something that we're keeping top of mind as we craft the regulations. A second goal is to consider transitions. And I think transitions can mean a lot of things, but the way that we're really thinking about it is that as change occurs, to meet the regulations and to meet the requirements of state law, it's really important to consider neighbors of a particular property and surrounding properties, their privacy, and how we can gracefully transition areas of higher density to lower density, especially the single family neighborhoods and adjacent slightly more dense neighborhoods. Missing middle housing is sometimes defined as a range of house scale buildings that have multiple units and are compatible in scale and form with what we typically think of as single family homes. So the missing middle housing types might be part of those transition areas in the city's existing multifamily neighborhoods and in mixed use areas. So for any particular development type, we really want to emphasize the importance of transitions to adjacent areas that may be of a different development type. And transitions are important to consider at a variety of levels in site design and architecture, including parking and access location, where noise might be greater, the visibility into windows and screening, and how buildings transition to the public realm as well. The third design or project goal that was identified is streamlining. And this is largely born out of state law compliance, but it's also good practice to remove unnecessary barriers as long as we've put in place the parameters to ensure the character of the community is represented. The current development process the development review process is shown here on this slide. A project, the applicant reviews the municipal code and the appearance review manual before submitting an application to the planning director. The planning director will review small projects, single family homes, or for larger projects, these are going to go through the design review committee or the DRC for multifamily projects. And then to the planning commission, if those projects are more than 12 units. So projects reviewed by the planning director don't require a public hearing, but those projects that go to DRC would require at least one hearing, and those that go to planning commission would require two, first with the DRC and then with planning commission before a project is approved. So with new state laws, the DRC and planning commission have somewhat limited discretion because you can't deny or reduce the density of these residential projects if they comply with the objective design standards. The fourth project goal identified is to encourage high quality outdoor gathering spaces. And we heard this from multiple people that outdoor open space really does provide a lot of opportunities for people to recreate, have respite, as well as supporting community building by interacting with neighbors. And in Atascadero, the existing setting with kind of a rural nature, the tree cover, open spaces are really part of the defining characteristics of the community. The fifth project goal relates to the eclectic nature of the community, and that's in an unequivocally positive way. A pitfall with objective design standards can be to force projects into a cookie cutter mold. And given the existing context of diversity of architecture in Atascadero, we really want to allow for that personality and differentiation in architecture to continue. And finally, we heard an important aspect to consider will be ways to support downtown and encourage pedestrian-friendly development and active uses, particularly in this location. So this will be one item that I hope we can come back to and answer some of these questions. Are these the right design and project goals to really frame our work moving forward, looking at tradition, transition, streamlining, the eclectic nature, outdoor spaces, and pedestrian vitality downtown? Did we get these ones right? And are there any others that we should be adding in to help us provide a lens with which the project should be viewed? So now I'd like to give a little bit more context on objective design standards. What do they mean? How do they work? And what they are. So when we talk about objective design standards, these are standards that can be quantified and measured. So because state law is leading jurisdictions towards these types of standards that streamline the approval of projects by removing subjectivity, the back and forth between applicants and decision makers is intended to be reduced and ultimately reducing project timelines and discretion in the decision-making process. Historically, cities have used both subjective and objective criteria to evaluate standards. Objective standards aren't new. We have a lot of them in place already. The height of building and the number of feet, that's an objective standard that's clearly defined how height is measured, and it's in a number that is pretty indisputable. Subjective standards and guidelines often would include the word should or other more kind of general design ideas that are really intended to guide the applicant toward a preferred outcome, and in an ideal world are super helpful to actually result in a kind of negotiation conversation about what the city's looking for and helping an applicant to get there. In our current context, we're limited in the use of that. Objective standards should really be read without resulting in two different interpretations by two different people. So these are measurements such as the example here, a 2-foot extrusion with a 10-foot horizontal length. Or they can be types of performance measures as well, meeting certain shade requirements at certain times of day or something like that. So While a city can make suggestions using subjective criteria, some of those guidelines that still exist, based on these new state laws that are in place, the city has to approve the project, even if the applicant refuses to make changes at times. So there is one pathway. If an applicant seeks to not comply with the objective design standards, then the project's not covered by the Housing Accountability Act, and the city can retain that discretionary authority. And in such case, like the subjective standards and any design guidelines can stay in place and be used to evaluate the project and go back to that kind of traditional way that business has been done. But the objective design standards provide an opportunity for the city to create those tailored standards and retain that local influence for those projects that don't seek to have an exception to the objective standards. So we want to make sure that components of good Atascadero-specific design are incorporated into the objective design standards. So what do the objective design standards affect? State law tells us that the objective design standards should apply to all new multifamily, multi-unit residential projects, and any mixed-use project that includes at least two-thirds of the project is residential. So the other one-third component is commercial, or I guess in rare cases, industrial, if they meet all the city's objective design standards. So notably, this doesn't apply to single-family housing. The objective design standards will apply in all the city zones that allow multifamily or residential mixed use. These are shown on the map here. And it's important to note we're not just thinking about the multifamily neighborhoods too, but also the corridors. As the map showed, we note that the city's major corridors and even some particular nodes along El Camino or Highway 41 or downtown might benefit from some extra unique attention that might differ from other areas of the city and certainly the multifamily neighborhoods. And fundamentally, a best practice for developing objective design standards is to integrate that good design and some flexibility into the standards, because we want to avoid a formulaic look to buildings, and because good design is a little bit hard to get right in objective standards. So that flexibility of providing a menu of options or other ways that we can add in flexibility is really important as a best practice to move forward toward that less formulaic look. Best practice also tells us that there are several high-level design elements that we have to consider for objective design standards. And they're really the foundation of what applicants do when they site plan out to lay out how much and where are they going to put their building on the property. The first is, what's the available footprint for development? In objective design standard speak, we call that setbacks, or how far a building is set back from a property line. Once the available footprint is defined, we must also define what is allowed up. What is the massing of the building? This includes height and the potential bulk of the building. And here's where we start to add some additional features that move us towards good design as well, through requiring building articulation or modulating the facade with protrusions and extrusions, and also roof forms that are less box-like and leading to kind of boxy architecture. Another important component is always the way a building relates to the street. So how does the front entryway relate to the street and welcome visitors while providing privacy? And really that interaction with the public realm is of crucial importance, not only in the mixed use, but especially in mixed use developments, but also in the multifamily neighborhoods. And how does a building feel as you're standing on the street in front of it? And finally, and this is a really important part, where do the cars go? And one thing that kind of goes hand in hand with that, what landscaping is required? These two are often at heads with each other. There's trade-offs for providing more parking and resulting in less open space and vice versa. But these two design elements really do tend to have a lot of influence on the way a site looks and feels. And finally, what materials are used on the building? Because even good design with kind of poorly chosen or cheap materials can result in a project being less than desirable. So this is the second component of discussion that we'd like to open up tonight and hear from you about. What are the most important design elements of that list of eight that you think that we should really take a special care to pay attention to ensure that we're getting the exceptional high quality multifamily housing that we want in Atascadero? So we'll come back to discuss these items and if there's anything else we want to add there. For next steps, after this meeting, we're anticipating a next meeting with council to provide further direction on certain key policy items that will help us kind of form that box within which we will prepare the objective design standards. After that meeting, we'll be a little bit quiet for a while as we start drafting some standards to bring them back for feedback to the DRC, the Planning Commission, and Council to consider some draft policy ideas. So that concludes the presentation. I'm going to open up the mural and turn it back to Madam Mayor.
Thank you, Genevieve. So on, if you could go back one slide.
Sure.
So the next steps, are you saying there's another meeting with council? All right, so we're, that's not this meeting. After tonight, there's another meeting with council for opportunity for us and the public to provide feedback. Then you'll go design those standards, come back with a draft, and then we'll have further meetings through DRC, Planning Commission, and Council. Okay.
That's what we're anticipating, correct.
Okay. And then to be clear, we're kind of giving high-level feedback tonight, and what I heard from you is it seems like three things. Number one, the design project goals, are you looking at the right ones? You want us to tell you, we think you're looking in the right direction. Two, you want to know if there are others that need to be considered. And then lastly, you have those eight design elements and you're asking us, you know, which three do you think are the most important? And of course, I want to say all eight of them. So I don't know if we're going to be able to do that for you, but we'll see. Okay, great. Thank you. It gives us some clarity as to what will be helpful tonight. All right, with that, I will look to my colleagues for questions of Genevieve and or Phil. Council Member Funk.
Thank you for that very informative presentation, Genevieve. I particularly appreciated the color-oriented display where you lighted up what the various standards mean and helped us visualize that. A few questions related to that. Could you go back to the map graphic where you show the areas of town where this will be applicable? There you go. So a lot of those areas are in fact commercially zoned currently. So is this applicable to any property owner who wishes to convert a commercially owned property to 100% residential use, or on the commercially zoned properties, is that only the mixed-use development standards applicable?
Correct. The latter. Oh, sorry. Phil, go ahead.
I can chime in, too, on that. So what's important to note is that in a commercial property, zoning still applies. So the ground floor land use has to be commercial, and upper floor uses could be residential with a conditional use permit in most cases, except for the downtown where a CUP is not required, and we allow mixed use without a CUP. But still, the ground floor is a commercial land use district. So it's almost like the zoning is broken up vertically rather than horizontally in those particular scenarios. So that's the typical scenario with mixed use.
Okay, thank you. Can we have different standards for different sections of the city? so that, for instance, allowing flat roofs downtown so that people could have rooftop usage in a synergistic way might be an option, whereas in areas that more abut residential, that we might look to require more articulation on the roof.
Absolutely. Yeah, and that's, I think, a key consideration in that transitions piece as well, and also thinking about those kind of key areas where we might want to have more design attention and something slightly different.
Okay. And as you look to things like you looked at and described a variety of different housing options, including things like bungalow courts, can this also include tiny homes and tiny home villages where people want to do those?
Absolutely. And I think there'll be, this kind of dovetails with the small lot subdivision piece as well. There will be some thought put to into that development of cluster tiny home developments as well. So there's often a breakdown where we look at the different building types, one of which is that kind of detached single family building type on one lot.
Okay, but a detached single-family building that is a cluster of 3,000-foot houses is a, you know, or a 3,000-foot houses, square-foot houses, is very different than one that is a cluster of 300-square-foot houses.
Very true, yes. And so as we look at different areas and where those, you know, where a particular area might lend itself more to more of the tiny home kind of flavor versus, you know, some of the more rural areas that might be more of the larger home area. I think that's an important consideration that we can include.
Okay. And how does this dovetail with our affordability standards? Can we build that into these projects so that if somebody gets all of this expedited processing, that there has to be a certain element of affordability, whether that's deed restricted or affordability by design?
I think that that's something that we can talk about as a policy option with the council. I think that there are some ways to kind of require things, incentivize things that we can talk about and integrate, and that might be a good policy question for the next meeting to dig into a little bit more.
Okay. And can we set standards that are situational in nature so that, for instance, there are situations where you want the kinds of articulations that, say, a balcony would entail, but we also have seen that in situations where you have taller buildings, we're dealing with the transition between multifamily or mixed use and residential, that a simple way to deal with some of the privacy and sightline issues is to not have balconies on overlooking particular types of properties. So is it possible to have things that are required in some situations and banned in others, or are allowed in some situations and banned in others?
Yeah, absolutely. As long as they are clear and objective and that they're easily discernible and not interpretable differently by two different people, we absolutely can have different standards for different situations. And I think that that transitions or the edge conditions is one of those key places where we'll have likely additional requirements placed upon buildings that would happen adjacent to a single family zone, for instance, that may have more care taken with privacy concerns or step backs or window alignment, or even prohibiting balconies in certain situations as well.
Okay. And you mentioned transitions between multifamily and single family environments. We also deal with, in this particular set of corridors, a lot of situations of transition between commercial and residential properties. There's a lot of these, you know, a lot of our commercial zone has residential immediately adjacent. So we're always managing that transition, both in terms of the impact of commercial developments on existing residential, but also we should, you know, can we also consider the zoning of nearby properties so that you don't end up having a multifamily that then, or you know, something that is approved by these design standards that makes it impossible to profitably develop the commercial property that it might be sitting next to. So that, you know, to allow something to, so that the owners of both types of properties can be accounted for. Can that be done?
Yes, and I think that that's kind of a key point to think about in transitions, in our interpretation of transition. Kind of, I'm envisioning some bullet points for us to just keep top of mind as we move through this, but thinking not just about the property that it's on, but also the commercial property. So often these are written, the impact of the commercial property on the residential, but right. That's an important lens that we can add into our thought process about transitions.
Okay. And let me see if I have anything else that is essentially a question. I think I'm good on questions for Ed, and then we can come back when we get into actual comments and discussion, but that gives me what I need to know about where we can go on this. Thank you.
Thank you. Other council questions? Councilmember Borbo.
Yes, thank you. I might have a couple follow-ons to some of the things Councilmember Funk raised. I'm curious, in the staff report, there's mention of, where the hell did I put it, allowing small lot subdivisions without having to come to the council. And this is in page 44 under program 3E. Consider allowing small lot subdivisions without rezoning. Right now, certain types of developments that require some level of council approval are then, as a result, placed into the community facilities district. And I'm wondering if we change that to allow small lot subdivisions without rezoning, or you know, put it more into a by right situation, does that mean they could not be required to join the community facilities district?
No, we can set the policy when projects will be in the CFD, and we would require that through the map process upon recordation of subdivision map based upon a particular threshold or number of units. So we have that control whether or not there's a rezoning on the property.
Okay, thank you. Because obviously there's a revenue concern there about the ability to sustain services for new residents. And so this sort of follows something Councilmember Funk asked about transition to neighboring properties that might be a different zone. If I just want to make sure I understood Genevieve's answer correctly, does that say you could have a different design objective design standard for a property that, let's say, borders a residential suburban area than you could on one that's in the middle of, you know, other commercial zone properties?
Yes.
Okay. And so you could say if you border, you know, a higher or a lower density residential area, you can't have three floors with balconies, or you can't have...
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yes.
So just to pick... Sure, I understood that correctly. You also said, or Genevieve did, about this applying to mixed-use situations where that were two-thirds residential, one-third commercial. Is that to say it wouldn't apply if, let's say, it was a 50-50? I'm thinking like, you know, a two-story development that's got commercial on the bottom and residential on top is... You know,
let's just say
50-50, but if a three-story one would be two-thirds, one-third.
Yeah, so you basically, yeah, like La Plaza would essentially trigger, by right standards or objective design standards, whereas if it was less 50-50, then it would not trigger that. It's interesting that that threshold's there. So,
well, it almost seems backwards to what
it
would
does.
Be,
maybe Genevieve can just add some light to that, but that's the way I see that. You know, yeah, it's interesting.
It sort of seems backward that yeah. you want to give the buy right if somebody's requesting less than to give it to somebody requesting more residential units. So, okay, and along those lines, Phil, you made reference to the mixed use being essentially a vertical thing where you're requiring commercial on the bottom and allowing residential on top. We have properties, and of course, we have a lot of properties in Tascadero that are not, you know, classic rectangles or squares. They're odd shapes, they're on curved roads, and they're on odd-shaped corners, et cetera. We have lots where one could envision there's no commercial frontage, but there's a lot of space in back. Can mixed use, and maybe this would not be a design standard, but so this might be a zoning question, you know, if we wanted to allow, you know, some of that residential in back as opposed to just on top?
We have that ability. We control that through zoning in our general plan. In fact, our general plan is quite vague on that and essentially alludes to allowing ground floor residential. Our zoning is not. It's a little bit tighter. That's something, though, that our council, our community has the discretion to modify as you suit. I will caution you on that, because once you open the door to ground floor residential, there's an incredibly high demand for it,
sure.
and it begins to dissolve and dilute your commercial districts, and maybe in certain scenarios it's really appropriate. I can see some certain properties where there's just no commercial viability, mid-block areas, certain areas, and we might want to consider that. It's just something you've got to do very carefully.
Right, but I think you hit the nail on the head that there just may not be any commercial viability for the back part of a property. Perhaps maybe you require, you know, a full commercial two-story building out front, but allow the mixed use to be horizontal as opposed to just vertical.
Yes.
But it sounds like that would not come under yes. this objective design standard discussion. That would come under...
They could actually come under this, but it's also more of a zoning and land use discussion about those thresholds and about percentages and about ground floor and upstairs. Mm-hmm. It's a good whole separate discussion.
Okay, thank you. And then this sort of relates to something Councilmember Funk asked, but I was looking, you know, when Genevieve was showing these various graphics, you know, with a different, it was kind of a rectangular set of lots, you know, and we also have one of these things here to talk about open space or... on a very small scale, what are we calling it, outdoor gathering spaces. And again, we have a lot of very small, oddly shaped things to where, and we have a lot of places where you know you can fit four units or six units. We're not talking large, you know, 15, 20, 30 units. So would these objective design standards, though, apply to very small lot situations, or what I'd say relatively small lot size situations where you're only going to get... I mean, if you're only going to build four units, it's not like you're going to have a park in the middle of it.
Again, that's where we have the ability to set thresholds and put those qualifiers into it. You're right. With a very small project, two, three, four, five units, certain things don't make sense. They just don't pencil out. And so we could do certain size thresholds before you trigger outdoor open space standards, before you trigger certain things, before you even trigger objective design standards. So we're wide open on that, and we're open to feedback as to how some of those thresholds might be developed.
Okay, thank you. And then last question regarding setbacks. When we had a discussion about SB 9, I think, you know, there was some discussion about the state requiring you to, let's say, authorize accessory dwelling units right up against, you know, like within 5 feet of a property line. And so, in other words, that you no longer had discretion as a community to say, no, we're, you know, we want to have 20 feet or something. But, you know, depending on the lot shape and size and everything, that might be desirable. By having objective design standards, are we able to address setbacks, or are we still just, you know, subject to whatever the SB 9 or other applicable state laws require?
We can address setbacks for multifamily. As long as those standards don't begin to substantially preclude density and what they could build on that property or what makes it more expensive. So we've got to be careful about that. As you increase setbacks, you might want to go up in height or do some other things. But we do have discretion, and it could create objective design standards on setbacks, especially when it's protecting neighborhood overlook and transitions. And when you, as you go up in height, you can increase setback. And typically a lot of communities do that. And they do it through each successive story, for example, so that each part of the building is a little further back. So that helps reduce overlook and helps reduce shadow and shading and all of those things. So all of those things are on the table.
I would like to add just a little bit of a caveat, though. The ADU laws and the SB 9 laws about minimum setbacks do trump the objective design standards. We can add additional ones, but the setback standards for SB 9 and ADU will still stand.
Yes. When it comes to ADUs and SB 9, I guess I'm just thinking of general multifamily units. So maybe we're talking about, it's true, yeah. We'd still have to allow for a 4-foot setback if it's truly an accessory dwelling unit or an SB 9 unit, but not a regular multifamily unit. So, right, Genevieve?
Correct. Yeah. Right. Correct.
Okay. The reason I was curious, though, is because I thought in this discussion we're talking about commercially zoned properties with potentially mixed use or multi-zone properties, whereas I thought SB 9 pertained to, ADUs on single-family zoned properties.
Yeah, SB 9 is only single-family zoned properties, and these regulations would only pertain to multifamily zoned properties. But ADUs, on the other hand, are allowed on multifamily and mixed-use properties. Didn't mean to add any more confusion.
Really? I guess I didn't really, in the sense that, I mean, I always thought of ADU as, on somebody next to somebody's single-family, next to or part of somebody's single-family resident, not as part of a multifamily zoned property.
I've always thought that way, too, but the state doesn't think that way anymore. Okay. The state wants them everywhere. So
all right.
They're part of an apartment project now, which is a really difficult thing to interpret. That's why it's taken us so long to bring the ADU policies back to you.
Right. Okay. Thank you.
Yes.
That's all I have, Mayor. Thank you.
I have a quick follow-up.
Councilmember Darris.
Thank you. Okay, on the ADU thing, because now you threw me, because we just went through this. On ADUs on multifamily zoned lots, they have to be built to their maximum density before that happens, or now has that changed?
That's not a state policy. That's something that we're contemplating with a local policy.
The
state doesn't have distinction on whether a property is built to maximum density. They basically say that you need to allow ADUs up to a certain limit on multifamily properties, 25% of the units, for example, or 25%. I shouldn't get into those details, but they do allow up to a certain threshold of ADUs on certain multifamily properties, whether or not they're built to density. I think we're proposing in some draft standards that we're going to bring you that a property be built to density before they start adding an ADU, because of the fact that if not, then people are just going to build ADUs, which will basically exempt them from a lot of the development standards and from the development impact fees just for the purpose of calling an ADU when they still have other density to build regular units. That doesn't make any sense.
Right. Thanks for that clarification, because I know we just went through this and you kind of threw me there. Thanks.
Other council questions? Regarding that ADU policy, would we be, I think of doing these objective design standards and then 6 months down the line, we figure out the whole ADU thing, and then we say, ooh, we would have changed the objective design standards. We would have done something differently or added in something that had to do with the ADUs if we knew what that ADU policy was. So I'm a little concerned that we would, and I know this is the first of several meetings, but I would be concerned about coming to any sort of finalization on this before that is a known quantity.
I think staff will have the ADU and SB 9 items to you prior to this being finalized, and they are kind of their own separate thing that are very, the straight regulations on ADUs and SB 9 units
But I mean specific. As it applies to multifamily, because that's what we're talking about with objective design.
Yeah, we're just talking about multifamily here, and ADUs and SB 9 are allowed, or actually ADUs are allowed in those zones, but they're going to come along with their own set of objective design standards. They could be the same as these objective design standards, but they're going to have their own separate code that speaks to that. And we can develop a set of objective design standards specifically for ADUs. And they can echo these.
But we are thinking about them all together because we know that they are intertwined. So I think to your point, Mayor, we're talking internally with staff about ADU and SB9 things as they go through and as we envision what the building types look like in the objective design standards. We'll also have to think about, well, what if? We always think about worst case scenario.
Yeah.
You know, the developer who reads it this way and does this thing, you know, we always want to plan for that. So we'll be thinking about that as we move forward.
And I'm trying to imagine, Genevieve or Phil, I don't know if you've seen ADUs done in multifamily. If you think of a potential 25%, what does that then do to any of these goals that we might have in terms of some sort of pedestrian, open areas, parking, all of those things? What does it do to that if you build to what the state says you can build to, and then you can add another 25%? And I'm having a hard time picturing, because I'm just picturing ADUs plopped in the middle of where either open space or parking lots would be. And, you know, obviously that can't quite be it, but it starts to feel, with state density combined with that, very crowded. And then this nice area for folks to live that's affordable has suddenly become a very cramped, hard to navigate.
There's a lot of pieces to this puzzle that we still need to put together.
Okay.
And that's one of them. But we would hope that we will be able to hang on to our basic design standards of a multifamily project, even with an ADU. And the intent is that an ADU gets built in existing space. Let's say, for example, you've got an apartment building that has multiple three-bedroom units, and someone converts the interior space of a couple three-bedroom units into other units, which can be done. That's the intent. Or they can convert parking, covered parking, for example, or garage parking into ADUs. That displaces parking. That is a concern, but that's what the state allows to have happen. We actually have an application like that going forward right now to convert covered parking areas, actually their garage parking areas, in a multifamily building into ADU units, and we have to allow that.
So now we're taking away parking, but we're doubling the need for the parking. All right. And there's no, we have no say in that. So residents, neighboring properties will be impacted by that, and there's
potentially
nothing.
Yes.
Okay. You said that we could address setbacks with multifamily, but we have to be careful. Well, if we have to have an objective design standard, what, I'm just curious what that could look like. Not that we're deciding on that here tonight, but I'm assuming that, you know, between you and Genevieve working together, we'd know what that could be.
I think I can answer this one. So I think what we mean when we say you have to be careful is just that we still have to allow up to the maximum density. So we can't put in place regulations that, you know, say the maximum density is 24 units per acre, but when we put in a setback of 40 feet, you can't actually achieve that.
Of course.
So that's what we're talking about. The laws have made it unequivocally clear that we do have to allow the density that's allowed by the general plan designation. So that's where we have to be careful.
Got it. I would ask, Director, have you seen, are there any, when we talk parking, I know that that seems to be the place where the state wants to give a lot, and I can understand why. What have you seen in some of our multifamily developments around town? Where has parking been done really well and it works well for the residents and the neighboring properties? And are there areas where it hasn't been done well and there's been a bigger impact that maybe was not intended?
We see both. It's a challenge in Atascadero because we don't have a lot of streets. We don't have a lot of on-street parking for our multifamily districts. A lot of our multifamily districts are along El Camino Real, where you've got these large multifamily projects with many, many, many units, and they don't have an interior street system. Instead, they have driveways that go directly out to El Camino Real, and El Camino Real, being an arterial roadway with busy traffic and limited parking options, is really problematic. You've got that, and then you've got other situations where you've got multifamily on a street, just a street removed from El Camino Real, and you already have a very limited system there, and you've got very impacted street parking, and it's very challenging. Then again, there's a few other multifamily projects where they've got dispersed parking, and it seems to work out, and they're close enough to downtown where they're using walking and transit, and all those things kind of work out, and that's where we're trying to go. But yeah, it's a bit of a conflict. It's a bit of a challenge, and we're not a community that is a very dense urban community with really good public transit. We're fairly detached from a job center. We're fairly detached from really good transportation. We have transportation, but when you're talking about a property that is, you know, 4 miles down El Camino Real, and it's a 4 mile walk to the store, and you've got limited on site parking, it's very challenging. And a lot of these standards, you know, are really good in a urban community, even as urban as something close as San Luis Obispo. But yeah, it's a challenge here.
Okay. Let's see. You were talking about the mid-block areas, and we've been talking about this for years. What is the commercial viability of some of those areas? I believe we're addressing that in the general plan update as part of the corridor study that's been done. Is that correct? If we look at some of those and say, okay, this would be a potential to be rezoned down the line.
Yes, that's best suited for rezoning when we look at the overall picture, and we look at these mid-block areas, and we look at where the demand is, and we look at commercial viability. And sewer connections and things like that.
Okay. And then I think it was Councilmember Funk had brought up the potential of deed restriction. Would something like that would be, I'm thinking that would be included in our inclusionary housing policy discussion, or would that fall under this conversation?
Deed restriction, maybe I missed that.
I think there were kind of two components to what Councilmember Funk said, talking about requirements or incentives for affordability, either deed restricted or affordable by design. The deed restricted component is absolutely a part of the discussion about inclusionary zoning. I could see a discussion about incentives for affordability by design being integrated into this discussion, because those become development standards that are objective and that we would want to think about as part of this process.
And so could you give me an example of what an incentive would be and what an affordability by design? Like, what would we say, hey, if you do this, then you get this?
For example, what some communities do is they measure density by the size of the unit. They'll say, okay, if you've got a really small unit that's 500 square foot, we're not going to call that a full unit. We'll call that a half a unit. So therefore, in a place where you could get only 4 units, now you can get 8 because they're so tiny, and it incentivizes those smaller units. On the flip side, if they say, okay, well, I'm going to build all my multifamily units to be 2,000 square feet each, which we commonly see, we might want to call that a 1.5 or a 1. So basically, you create these standards that incentivize a smaller unit. May not count the bedrooms, but it looks at the size of the unit and says, hey, if you're this size, you're half a unit. If you're this size, you're 0.66. If you're this size, you're 1. If you're this size, you're 1.5. And so you get this sliding scale. You know, a lot of our multifamily districts in Atascadero are developed with generally these larger homes, planned developments. And that's just been, you know, historically in the past, the nature of the beast. And I think we're trying to get some affordability by design just to get these numbers up and the state policies met. So that's just one thought. You can also do it the other way by mandates.
Okay. Thank you. That's helpful. Let's see. And also the question about the tiny homes, I would see that, I guess, in two options, Genevieve, is that one in the small division sublot, that would be a different conversation. But here, I think what I heard you say is that if somebody had a multifamily lot and wanted to do a tiny home village on a multifamily lot, that is a potential that we could add into this conversation.
Kind of both. So yes, I think that cluster development on a multifamily lot is something that we're looking at through the objective design standards. And this project that MIG is scoped to do on this component of objective design standards and small lot subdivisions will also be looking at the larger small lot subdivisions. But I think there's conversations around that happening in the general plan that we're melding with. To hear community input on and those pieces. So we'll meld that piece back in. But it is, those are both components of the project that we'll consider.
Okay. All right. Thank you. All right. Any other questions before we go to the public? Councilmember Funk.
Thanks. Just one more. As regard to what extent are these objective standards amendable over time? because we're talking about standards that will involve housing assets that are going to be around and housing people for a couple of additional generations of transportation technology, for instance. I mean, none of our existing homes were probably built in before, you know, when zip cars had, you know, nobody had thought of that. And there will be, God willing, these houses will be in place when the first all-electric automatically driver trolley starts running back and forth on El Camino Real. So can we, to what extent are they amendable?
Anytime you want. 3 times a year, 4 times a year, hopefully not, though. But sure, there's not locked in. So we could adjust all the time as you see fit, as trends change and things move. And zoning is an ongoing experiment.
Okay. but we just have to be attentive to the fact that whatever our current experiment is, the worst or best case use of it is going to be there for a long time.
Yes. I think that there's always, it's good to check in on big zoning changes like this after they're implemented, because there's always unforeseen consequences, no matter how hard we try to check in, modulate, adjust, and track it moving forward. Change it as you want.
Okay, thank you.
All right. So, Genevieve, if you could help me as we go to public comment, let's keep this on the screen right now. For anyone who would like to speak, just so you know, you can speak to anything here, but so that you know the three things that we're asking about. Number one, are these the right design projects and goals? So we're looking at just sort of keeping the tradition of the type of architecture that we have here. We are looking at transitions between different types of neighborhoods, streamlining, that outdoor gathering spaces, sort of that eclectic type of feel. We don't want to have, like, everybody has to make this cookie cutter type project, and then the pedestrian vitality downtown. Do I have those correct, Genevieve? Those are the six we're looking at?
Correct. Yeah.
Okay. So number one, are these the right things to be looking at? Number two, are there other design projects or goals that we need to add? And then thirdly, if you want to bring that up, thank you. There are 8 design elements, possibilities that we have here. And not that we won't be looking at all of them, but what staff is looking for, or what are the ones that you think are really critical? So that includes setbacks, which is how far something is from a property line. It would include massing, like, you know, the mass of the building and how that appears. The articulation or roof forms, meaning that there's some visual interest in. And I'm sure Councilmember Darris could explain that much better than I just did. The orientation of the frontage, how the frontage of the property interacts with the street. We're looking at the orientation, frontage of the property. Then we also have relationship to the street. And then circulation and parking, open space and landscape, and then the materials that are used. So those are the 8 things. So as you provide us any input, we would love to hear whatever you might have to say, and particularly as it relates to these 3 things that we're looking at. So anyone here who would like to speak, if you would like to come to the podium, and anybody in the webinar, go ahead and raise your hand. If you're on the phone, is anyone on the phone, Luke? No? Make your way to the podium right over here, and I just state your name, and you've got 3 minutes. We'll have a timer on for you.
Hi, thank you, council members, for the chance to speak on this important issue coming to your city. My name is Kimmy Nguyen. I'm a community member. I'm a planner by trade, and I'm also a housing advocate for a group called Yimby Action here in SLO County. Many people who, you know, choose to live or grew up in Atascadero do so because, you know, not so far in the distant past, Atascadero was known as, like, an affordable place to live in the county. So this is just, I think, one tiny piece of what the city and city council can do to try to keep it that way. Regarding, you know, the 4, 5, 6 different topics, just some things that jumped out at me. I would really encourage the project team to look at cutting down on expensive space-intensive regulations wherever possible. I know parking is really important in a city like Atascadero. Outdoor recreation, open space areas, storage, These are all really critical parts to the lifestyles we live here in the Central Coast, but any space we give to that is space that we're not giving to units, so just keep that in mind. I would also caution staff to not prescribe architectural styles. It can be very tempting, especially when you have a place which is with as much tradition as a Tascadero. Once you start going down that path, you will get cookie cutter. You will get, you know, boring, bland, stamped, tract housing, and no one is really excited to live there, I would think. The other thing that came to mind was one of these topics was transitions. And as I heard Genevieve describe it, and as the city council members talked about it, I heard this value of wanting to, you know, be very mindful of when new development comes in, bordering single-family homes, really protecting single-family homes and those established neighborhoods. I would challenge that idea and that assumption and just ask you guys to think it actually may be the most protective thing you can do for your community to make sure that those residents that already live there, their friends, their family, their children, their children's children have a place to live here and affordable places to live. Those are becoming more and more rare here in the Central Coast. And yeah, I just am excited to see where this goes and we'll do my best to keep up with it. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Nguyen. And we have another speaker coming up. And then I think I did see someone in the webinar. We will get to you momentarily. Please keep your hand up.
Good evening, council members. My name is Krista Jeffries, and I used to live in North County. My husband and I lived in Paso for 2 years, and when we needed another bedroom, when our family grew, we looked everywhere in North County, including Atascadero, where we had friends, we had a church, we had a community up here that we really loved. And even with a budget of what sounds really paltry today, of $430,000, we couldn't find anything in all of North County in 2015 when we had my son. And I come to you today as a neighbor who lives in Grover Beach now, because that was the only place we could find somewhere, with a broken sewer, by the way. and I hear these conversations across the county in multiple jurisdictions, over the course of the last couple of years that have been advocating for housing abundance and housing affordability. And I hear a lot of those same concerns echoed in the conversation you had today of a real concern that if we don't have an exact line of where one thing starts and another thing stops, then that's going to cause harm to our communities and it's going to hurt the way our city looks. And when we think about what our favorite buildings are, it's almost always a building that was built before we had almost any objective design standards. And we had a more slow-paced and smaller footprint for buildings. We had a development pattern that was more incremental, and it produced buildings that we love, even though they would be illegal to build today under our own design standards and our parking regulations and our height limits and all of those things. And so when you think about what you want Atascadero to look like, which I know is the subject right now, I really want you to think about Atascadero in terms of flexibility and strength for changes in the market, changes in our community, changes in who lives here, what businesses come here. I know Atascadero really needs jobs. And though we talk about housing first a lot when it comes to homelessness, housing first is also a great principle for bringing more jobs. You need people to live here. Homes are where jobs go to sleep at night. And if we want to become a community that looks more like authentic, historic Atascadero, but also meets the needs of the future, we really have to resist the temptation to be overly prescriptive, overly controlling. I feel like we have exchanged control over our communities for strength, because strength is found in flexibility and the ability to change and modify slowly over time, rather than here's the stone wall and you can't cross it without being able to jump over it, if that makes sense. So I would encourage you to approach this issue with a sense of urgency and courage, and think about what's going to happen in order for your kids and grandkids to be able to live in this community. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Jeffries. And looking to the webinar, I see a Devin, is it Hagee? Hagee?
That is correct.
Good evening.
Good evening. Thank you for allowing me to speak. My name is Devin Hagee. I'm a owner of a residential multifamily zone 24 lot in Atascadero. I've been looking at developing it the last year and a half, 2 years, and I seem to keep coming back on the same issues, the parking requirements, the setbacks, and open space. I would like to do a very affordable units, like a little tiny village or anything like that. But it always seems to come back that the setbacks and the parking requirement does not allow me to have the footprints that's needed for that. As you guys go forward to set the what's important for you, I just ask that you have maybe a flexibility for different restrictions, especially if this lot's located close to a regional transit hub or any other affordability on the property. Just the design standards really tie my hands of my availability to do the development to the best of the lot potential.
Thank you, Mr. Hagee. You still have time if there's anything else you would like to say.
That was it. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, sir. If there's anyone else in the webinar who would like to speak, I know there's a few more of you there. Feel free to raise your hand. Anyone on the phone, Luke? No? Okay. I'm not seeing anyone else, so I will go ahead and close public comment and bring it back to council for conversation. We are not making a motion on anything tonight. We're simply giving feedback on these three items. So thank you to those members of the public who did speak tonight. Affordability is, you know, obviously an issue that's being experienced throughout the state and has been for several years. You know, we're up here doing the best that we can to help navigate how do we provide more affordable housing, but also mitigate the potential impacts. And so we want to be flexible, and then we also see things happen where we're flexible and then suddenly you end up with something that really doesn't work well, and we want to avoid that to the extent possible. And so that's why you see us sort of wrestling with these issues up here. I think when we looked at La Plaza, one of the things we said is that people who want that downtown living environment and they're committing to, hey, I've got this one parking space or whatever this limited parking was, they knew they were going into that. And we as a council said, that's fine, that's good. You know, can that be done in other areas? Or do people just come with all their cars and they park them throughout other neighborhoods and then we end up with an impact? So those are the kind of things we need to look at. And because we don't have as many of the jobs here and people are driving elsewhere, we're working to correct that. But cars are for the, you know, for the foreseeable future, they are important to folks to be able to go about their daily life of having jobs, taking kids to school, and that type of thing. I think many of us up here probably either walked or rode our bikes to school, but that doesn't happen much today. So, and of course, we have different kinds of streets than some of us grew up on. So we have a lot of things that we're thinking about. And Genevieve, if you would go ahead and bring up number one that you want our feedback on, just so we can have a conversation on that and we can kind of go through these three.
Oh, can you see my screen?
It's there. Oh, sorry. Okay. If someone could change our Zoom screen so that we see less of each other and more of the...
Yeah, exactly.
I know exactly what Charles looks like. Okay. I don't need to... Okay, that's a little better.
And Ben and Mayor?
Yes.
Any chance we could do just like a 2-minute stretch break and stand up? And
oh, absolutely. Why don't we do that? It is currently 7:31. Why don't we come back at 7:35 after a quick break?
Thank you.
Good idea.
marketing. That does include you, Councilmember Forbeau.
We're always waiting on you. Did you tell him that? Always waiting on Charles.
The late Charles Forbeau. I love that. All right, we are back from our comfort break and on to council having conversation. Wouldn't even call it deliberation, but I think Councilmember Forbeau, you had a couple of questions before we.
I did, Mayor. Thank you. Follow on questions. One regarded the issue the mayor raised, and Phil, you answered it in terms of saying, if you allowed a small unit, let's say 500 square feet, it might now count as a full unit. And so you could allow greater density to encourage smaller units. But is that something that could be addressed through these objective design standards? Or is that something that would involve changing zoning? So that, if you were allowing 24 units an acre, you'd allow more if they were really small units.
It can be addressed through these objective design standards, but it does result in an amendment to the way the zoning regulations are written. It doesn't really change the overall density of a property in terms of the land use, because it kind of all irons itself out, because it's all relative. But it is an interpretation of the way the zoning is written, and we would have to amend the zoning code for that kind of a thing. Not a huge situation, but it certainly is one of the more commonly used practices of incentivizing affordable by design. Many, many communities use that kind of scenario.
Okay, thank you. Because it seems to me that the only way to produce more affordable housing in the sense of relatively affordable is higher density and smaller units. It's the only way to make things cheaper. The other question is, on the issues we're talking about here that start with the traditional, and maybe I wasn't paying enough attention the first time, but I'm trying to understand the distinction between tradition and eclectic. Because while we do have some traditional aspects in Atascadero, I think many people would describe our community architecture as eclectic, sometimes painfully so. But in general, it's a good feature. And so I wanted to understand if there's not an inherent conflict between the concepts of tradition and eclectic. Can you show those or clarify that for me again?
Yeah, I think that they kind of go hand in hand a little bit, but because, your tradition has resulted in this eclectic nature, but foundationally, the tradition is really thinking about how was the Atascadero formed? What are the colony homes and how that was thought out with, the colony homes are here and the colony homes on corners were designed as duplexes. And some of that kind of original colony flavor that set the foundation for the town. Certainly, as time went on, there were a variety of different things that happened that resulted in kind of the eclectic nature that exists today. So it kind of rests on the tradition and the foundation of the history, and the more near-term history has resulted in the eclecticism of town. So I do see them as kind of two different things that are both kind of inherent to what Atascadero is. I don't know if y'all agree, though.
Well, okay, thank you. I was asking partly because of some of the public comments regarding don't dictate, design or appearance so much that it, potentially increases costs, and I would have to agree with that. I mean, there's certainly some neighborhoods that have adopted like the Craftsman 1920s style. It looked very attractive, but I don't think we should tell people that's what they need to do or make it a standard to approve their project. We should allow, that to be a designer's choice to a large degree, and we'd also have the DRC and others that can look at that sort of thing if necessary. But, the more requirements usually ends up equaling more cost. So, thank you.
Okay, so if, why don't you bring up the kind of number, really number one and two go hand in hand. So if we could bring those up again and minimize our squares of what we see and bring up the slide, that would be great.
All right, I should be sharing it now.
Okay. So I would ask my colleagues, are we, when we're looking at design and project goals, so this isn't the parking and the other things, are these the things that we're finding, do we think these are the right project goals? So I would ask for feedback from my council members of these six. Are these the right design and project goals? And also, do we think there were other things that needed to be added from a design and project standpoint? And Genevieve, just to clarify, when we go to the others, then we start talking parking and all of these other things. That's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about the design, how it looks.
And here we're talking about the character of Atascadero that we want to see reflected, the things that are important to the community that we want to see reflective, that kind of can give us some lens to think about. These are kind of the, you know, it's kind of the guiding principles for the project of, you know, don't forget, this is important. That's kind of where we're getting here before we dig into some of the particulars around site planning.
Okay. So I would look to, so Mayor Pro Tem Newsom followed by Councilmember Funk.
So some of my thought process on this is that streamlining, I kind of see more of a process of a flow of activities versus tradition, eclectic, transition, outdoor gathering spaces. I think that's a huge part of our community. We want to maintain that in every aspect that we're doing as we design. And pedestrian vitality in downtown, I think that is maybe a node inside of the whole picture as itself. So I know our community throughout has got little design, like traditional concepts downtown, eclectic on south side, north side's a little bit more rural. I just think some of them might be more detailed. I think that we need to continue individuality as well as, I don't want to limit by standards. So I think streamlining the design review process and the construction permit isn't an actual project goal. I think it's something that we do every day and it's part of essentialism. That's my take on it.
And so are you saying like the pedestrian vitality downtown that, and then talking about the eclectic, are you saying that there are like kind of different areas that have different feels to them and just kind of let that keep marinating as we move forward? Is that?
I think that we're never going to have, it's right now it's cohesive just because it's just Atascadero. I think that these are just ways of describing their architecture, tradition there, eclectic there, outdoor gathering spaces is something that we do amongst all of those. Vitality downtown is, you know, an area. I don't see it as necessarily a design. Every project that we do, we always take that into consideration, is pedestrian. How does it impact our children, our cars, how it flows? Downtown is always a huge focus for us. I don't think that when we're doing a project on the south side of town, we're going to evaluate the downtown in that. So as we look at Del Rio area, again, it's not related to downtown, but we do want to look at pedestrian vitality. So I think that's key to everything that we look at. Outdoor gathering spaces, again, that's outdoor. We look at that every time we do a project. Tradition, eclectic, and transitions, I just think they're a design style.
Okay. And then on to number two, because I'm going to ask this of each of you, are there any other design standards, project goals that maybe aren't seen here that you think belong?
I think six is a lot. I think that if we narrow it down to like four, I don't want to add any more to it. How's that?
Okay. Councilmember Funk.
Thank you, Madam Mayor. I think I concur with Mayor Pro Tem Newsom's comments about outdoor gathering spaces. That is the indoor-outdoor connection and the use of our outdoor spaces is distinctively a Tascadero. I do think we need to allow some flexibility for small unit entities, particularly we've got a lot of flag lots in Atascadero. So how we're developing these really deep lots adds complexity for how you set up both the setbacks and the kinds of outdoor spaces that you can create. But I would like to see, you know, anything over maybe six units have some kind of outdoor space that is large enough for four people to sit down for dinner or something, some kind of a standard of that, or for a space that a small child or a couple of small kids could play in. You can do a lot of things to make quality interaction in small spaces, but to build interaction into our multifamily units is really important to the quality of life. I'm less fussed about tradition. We have wonderful traditions, but we are also indeed eclectic. And I think that that we can be more flexible if one of our commenters mentioned, Ms. Jeffries, mentioned that if we don't put too many expectations on it. So I'd say, not get too fussed about tradition. I do think we have to be attentive to transitions, both to single-family residential and to commercial, without getting tied up in knots about it. Because your single-family residential can turn around and put an ADU right next to the lot, and then you've got another bedroom window that you're worrying about oversight into. Those kinds of things can happen. You can manage some of those connections with landscaping over time, and sound walls and those kinds of things if really necessary. That's a bit of a mixed bag of feedback, but I think that both, yes, let's pay attention to it, and let's be careful not to get too onerous on it. Streamlining is part of what we're trying to achieve by doing this. It's the nature of the thing, and I don't know that we need to make it a separate goal. It is the nature of this process. Pedestrian vitality, we should look at that not just in downtown, but also in nodes. As we start to think about our El Camino Master Plan and how we looked at several areas that are nodes, we're not going to be able to have walkable neighborhoods in all parts of Atascadero. But we should be attentive to some areas where we can at least create walkable, bikeable connections to El Camino Real, and be thinking about how multifamily housing can be in neighborhoods where the kids can walk down to the store or to a park. And there are ways to connect to create pedestrian vitality within particular neighborhoods and we have to be careful not to do something that inadvertently applies those goals to our Western Hills, where that's not going to make any sense. Our Western Hills aren't really in the areas that are applicable for this, but so we need to be attentive. In terms of I would be keen on that approach that Councilmember Burbeau was just asking about, in terms of being able to encourage smaller units. by allowing them to count as, you know, half or two-thirds of a unit, that kind of thing. And likewise, if somebody's going to put in a particularly large unit, that would count as, you know, one and a half, say. So that would help us incentivize affordability in a natural way that's not burdensome and that allows designers flexibility to create cool places to live. Let's see. I think what I don't really see addressed here so much, except maybe in outdoor gathering spaces, but specifically shade. We are in an area where it does get very hot in the summer, and the trees, a natural shade, to the extent they can be preserved. And that, again, is going to be something that preserving the trees on a site often makes it unworkable to develop. So, you know, can we do a little something but not get carried away on that? And I just think we ought to think about how, so that's the challenge back to the design team. How do we deal with that kind of requirement so that you build shade, not just preserving the existing, but also then allowing for places where trees can become large in the future so that in the, you know, 40 years or 60 years or 80 years that somebody might be living in that property, that eventually that 15-foot-high valley oak you planted is going to be a big, beautiful shade tree. And so you allow for that. Architecturally, as I said, I'm not fussed, but I see in my notes, without getting overly prescriptive, we just want a lot to look industrial. And when I think industrial, I'm thinking about large flat spaces that go up multiple stories. So articulation, windows, you know, things on features, those are helpful. Consider what balconies are going to be overlooking before we allow or require them. Let me see if there's anything else here. Fractional density. Where in this do we talk about parking?
That's number three, and we'll get to that. We're just doing these first two. So
I'll come back to parking.
Okay.
Now that's the thing. And I do think that we should allow some flexibility in roof design based on location. So, you know, let us have rooftop activities downtown where we're already looking to do that with a rooftop bar that's going to open in
maybe a few weeks. You're going down to number three, so
Okay.
I know. It's exciting. I totally get it.
Okay, sorry.
I'm holding back on that because they want to know the three most important things, which I know is going to be hard for us, but I want to have a separate conversation.
Right.
So are you complete on that first part?
Yeah, so I think, if I have to choose three of those.
No, not yet.
Okay.
Not yet. So number one and number two, I think you've given the feedback on. We'll get to number three and after we hear from the others.
Right, okay, but you didn't need me to choose three of number one.
Three items of number three is what we're going to choose, which is where parking and that will come into play.
Okay.
And roof articulation and all of that.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
But
I know.
We'll get this aligned. I'm
trying to keep everything all organized here, and it's a lot of balls.
Sure.
All right.
So I think we're there, and we can also consider differing height standards depending on where it is in the block and where we are relative to, you know, the kind of node or things. To create visual experiences that make sense so people want to enjoy these neighborhoods that may have distinct character to them. That'll do me.
All right, thank you. I'll ask Councilmember Darez, followed by Councilmember Borbo.
All right, I think I'm understanding we're just staying on number one here.
One and two. Two is, do we need to add anything to number one?
Oh, okay. Well, I may not get to that, but I'll stick with these six that we're showing right here.
Okay.
On tradition, I'm not particularly stuck on tradition, but I do think that there are areas of town where it is important, especially downtown. But I think, you know, I'm not big on eclectic type of architecture in certain areas, but I think it has its place. So the tradition, I think, you like to say, it's good, but we need to be careful in how we apply it. On the transitions, you know, that's, to me, that's an important one. You go from one type of neighborhood and then abruptly into another type. It could potentially be an issue. Setbacks, I think, are really important. The architecture compatibility with what's existing, I think, is important. I had some notes on that. The density as well. I think, you know, we need to be careful on those types of things. Streamlining, I will agree with Mayor Pro Tem Newsom on that one. That's something that we do. I think it's a very necessary process that we have through this. It's a good oversight because we're going to have all these design objectives that we need to try to apply. I think it's just a necessary oversight to look at projects as they come through individually, to look at the goals, the three important that we're going to wind up choosing here shortly. And as far as quality of life, absolutely, outdoor gathering spaces are extremely important. We talked about earlier depending on the number of units, you know, what's going to require an outdoor gathering space. If it's 4 to 6 units on a property, chances are each one of those units are probably going to have their own little outdoor space, possibly. If not, there needs to be a common space. But an outdoor space, I think, is extremely important for quality of life. And again, the eclectic type of architecture, I've seen some really weird eclectic architecture that, again, it's all subjective, I suppose. But that's where the review process will come in on that. It can be really good. It can make a neighborhood very interesting. So there's certainly some positives to that. Pedestrian vitality. We have some major challenges here in Atascadero with pedestrian vitality. And if we can incorporate ways on properties to connect to neighboring properties to get downtown, we've done with bike paths in certain areas, I think that's certainly an important thing. We have, you know, the terrain and topography sometimes is a challenge. The width of our streets are not designed. We don't have sidewalks in a lot of areas. But I think it's something that's very important, and that certainly goes to the quality of life for what we're trying to do on the design objectives. And if I've gone through these the way you expected, I think I'm finished.
Is there anything you think needs to be added to this, the project goals, design goals? And this doesn't include parking and roof articulations. Well, we're getting to that next.
Okay. Well, can you scroll so I can see what you've got on number 2? Because I think what Charles mentioned, and I talked a little bit with Phil on this a little bit, you know, the unit size, you know, what constitutes a unit? I believe Susan mentioned this also as well.
So the idea of the 0.5.
Yeah, the 0.5. I mean, because okay, I think that's going to be.
That's on here.
Yeah.
Good. Okay.
Okay. So that is on there. Massing, I think. We've talked about massing. That's coming. Okay,
so massing, setbacks, roof articulation. We're going to get to that in a moment.
Building articulations. Okay. So at this point, I don't have anything to add. If something comes up, then I'll bring it up later.
Okay.
Thank you.
Cool. And Councilmember Borba.
Yes. Could you scroll up to the top again? I mean, because the basic question is, are these the right design project goals?
Yep.
For me, you know, streamlining is clearly mentioned in here in the staff report, I mean, as one of the primary purposes of doing this. So that's a very important goal to this, to me. When I look at tradition and eclectic, it just strikes me as trying to dictate design. And I don't see that to me as being important. We have both traditional architecture in town, and we have a wide variety of eclectic architecture, and I don't believe that we need to be telling people what their place should look like from a from that sort of architectural standpoint. I'm not sure under which of these categories you would put the things that Councilmember Funk asked about a couple times, and that is, like, you know, articulating buildings so, you know, the second floor is set back a little bit so you don't get the just box.
That's a set of boxes.
Okay.
Yeah.
But I think is important in the sense of the architectural sense. But whether it's Spanish tile, Craftsman, modern, 50s, I don't see that as something we need to get into telling somebody, if you do one of these things, it'll meet our objective design standards versus the functionality of, okay, this should be set back or no balcony if you're overlooking a place, which is pertains to the transition piece. The outdoor gathering spaces, I think we all appreciate the desire to have those, and a couple of comments were made relative to quality of life. But remember here that everything we require somebody to do, and every space we require them to utilize to do it, is going to cost money. It's going to drive up the price of the existing units. And for a lot of these young families, I think the point is their biggest quality of life issue is finding an affordable place to live. I don't think we should have no outdoor gathering space requirement, but I think we should be very careful about what we require in that regard, because again, every square foot we require somebody to dedicate to that sort of thing is going to drive up the cost of units. And then on the pedestrian vitality downtown, I think that's important, and downtown is a unique area and should have some of its own objective design standards, but I'm going to clear my mind what one example would be that we would put on a developer proposing to build something to say, we need you to do this to enhance pedestrian vitality because, the sidewalk sizes are set now, and they're fairly large in the downtown area, et cetera. So I'd like to say that's important, but I'm a little unclear how that would relate. And then as far as adding additional things, I don't have any additional ones to add.
Okay, thank you. Genevieve or Director, Councilmember Darrows had said, in terms of, tradition or eclectic, not too excited necessarily about either one, but that would be taken care of through the review process. And my understanding is there is no longer a review process.
That's not actually accurate. There still is.
There is.
We can have. So here's the situation.
I mean, an actual review process where we have a say in anything.
Well, we do still. So okay. We can retain our same review process that we have today. The state's asking us, hey, could you up those thresholds? Could you make it easier? Can you find ways to make them get through the process easier? But what we can't do is with our review process, if someone comes in with a multifamily project, we can't say, well, you're allowed 12, but the way we're going to do this is you're only going to get 6 units on your property because we want you to do X, Y, and Z. We can't do that, or we can't deny the project. So it's kind of, they're allowed to do it, and we can guide them, but they don't want us to be subjective in that guidance. They want us to have these objective standards to guide them. But we can still have the process, and we can still have the neighborhood input, and we can still have a hearing for certain size threshold of projects, whatever threshold we decide that to be. Right now, for example, 12 units or more require a conditional use permit. Less than that doesn't. We can change that threshold, make it something different. Or we could say, if you comply with all the objective design standards, don't go to a hearing, go straight to approval construction permit, as an example. But we can do whatever we want. We still have a process that we can maintain. It's just that we can no longer deny or restrict or reduce density through that process.
Which certainly ties your hands, yeah.
Well, but then why have the process? If they come through a process of review, but we can't deny something, what is the point of review? That just seems like another layer of something over which we have no control, but we're making somebody jump through hoops. What is the review?
Possibly, but if
I'm hearing some feedback. I don't know if someone's got mics on or there's some background noise in someone's home, maybe.
There is some background noise somewhere.
Okay.
So, for example, if someone says, well, I can't meet all of your objective design standards, we would have them go through a process. So then we come into discretionary land. Or we could say, okay, you've got a 50-unit project, you're meeting all objective design standards, but you've got such a big project, we still want to hear from the neighborhood because there may be issues that we're not aware of, and there may be a CEQA threshold or other things we need to look at environmentally. So there's still that side of things through a discretionary process. So there's still value in it, even though you can't outright deny it, but you can still review with those objective design standards and with the California Environmental Quality Act. So it's a fine line to dance. It's a little challenging. Okay. And I don't know if you want to add anything to that.
Let's not get into too much detail. Okay. Really what I'm taking away is we need to make sure these objective design standards, and granted, we can change them down the line if we figure out, wow, we got that one wrong, or we need to add this or take that away. But I'm going to make these decisions under the assumption that we really have no discretion down the line for any type of review. Because that's really what we've been talking about tonight. And then to say, well, maybe in this little instance over here. No, we need to look at this as though 95% of these are going to go through without any real further review if they meet these objective design standards.
Correct.
Okay. So in that case, eclectic, I don't view eclectic as a style. I view eclectic as we might have tradition, we have different types of architecture all over town. That's just simply how, and probably how most towns are. So I would find it, I don't want to direct like, oh, you have to have this style or this cookie cutter. So in looking at number three below, when we talk about massing and articulation, can enough standards be put together there that whether it's tradition or whatever type of architecture, that it produces something that is aesthetically pleasing and fits in with the environment based upon those items below without having to say traditional architecture?
Yes, exactly. Okay. And so okay. The skin can be any skin. It's just meeting those basic elements.
Okay. As much as I love a lot of our traditional architecture, I don't need to apply that to these objective design standards. If we wanted to look at some area in the downtown where we did that and we thought it made sense and there's some sort of, you know, cohesiveness, but even downtown we have, you know, some eclectic things, and it's fine. We, you know, I like our downtown. So transitions, I think, are important. The streamlining, I won't repeat things that everybody has said. I would agree with Councilmember Bourbeau on the outdoor gathering spaces as much as I think it's really important, you know, to a quality of life. I remember we were having this conversation a year or so ago with the Planning Commission, and one of our younger Planning Commission members said, you know, a yard, it's more important that I have a home and not necessarily a yard. We had an older Planning Commissioner that was like, well, people need yards with kids. And she said, no, like, I'm going to take my kids to the park. So if we're talking affordability, and does a family want to pay an extra $50,000, you know, for a home so that they can have a little open space there, or is it worth it for them to have an affordable place to live and then take their kids to the park or go to the park? So I think we have to be careful there. And my question would be, Mr. Hagee was saying he's got this, you know, multifamily 24 unit, and with the open space in the parking, that's a little bit challenging. And I'm curious, you know, and we're not talking about his thing tonight, but that just makes me think, you know, if that can't be developed because we've got these open space or these issues, then we really do need to look at that. So that I want us to be careful, as Councilmember Bourbeau said, that we don't make that so prominent that we're reducing the number that can be made. But I do understand the importance of it. So isn't that nice? I'm giving you an answer that it's important and don't do too much of it. Is that helpful? Yeah, Charles said exactly. So, all right. Yeah, trees, making sure. All right. I think you all have, I'm going to ask Genevieve, Director, in number one and two, you really have a sense of where we're coming from, or is there something where you say, I really need to clarify this with you?
I would like to propose something and see how that sits with you.
Perfect.
So it sounds to me like we could make a few changes to this as far as our framing. I think that we could combine tradition down into eclectic and recognize that some of your history is part of the eclecticism that kind of makes that, and that's just a piece of it. I think that We could change streamlining into flexibility, because I heard that in a number of different locations, and I don't see that as kind of a design goal, and I think that encompasses streamlining a little bit, but also can help us frame some of our thought process as we craft this.
Sure.
And then the other piece is that I don't know if you know, we're dropping one, so I know Mayor Pro Tem Newsom, we're not going to go over six, and I agree. We can't have too many things to think about. It's better to have fewer. But if there's anything else that you do want to add, I think the thing that came up the most is this encouraging smaller unit sizes piece and the affordability. And I don't, so I'd just like to ask if that feels like it elevated up enough to make that something that we kind of think about top of mind as one of our six goals.
To me, that would fall under flexibility, yeah. Particularly when we talk about, you know, a size. It could be considered a half a unit or a unit and a half, depending upon, you know, 500 square feet or it's 2,000 square feet. And so I think that falls under flexibility.
Okay.
I'm hearing council members say I agree, so let's do that.
Okay, and about combining tradition and eclectic?
I think we're good on that.
All right. That's helpful for our framing process.
Great. So let's go down to the third one. And
I'll zoom out.
I don't want to pick any of them because they're all important. I think what I was mentioning before, you know, and I've heard others of my colleagues, we don't want to be, you know, onerous in our, you know, it has to look like this, which is what we just said, but we also don't want to end up with, you know, a big box. We don't want to end up with something that is, you know, I'll just use ugly, you know, that a place where people don't want to live, or it looks like it's, you know, a prison or something. So, and obviously that's not what most people want to build, but the things that would be key to that seems like it would be the, you know, the articulation and the materials and the massing. Those things need to be looked at. But can I say, oh, those three are more important than all the rest? You know, maybe, but why are you asking for three out of the eight? Is it because you're not going to really focus on the other five, or do you just want to hear from each of us and kind of get a sense of what the most important thing is?
You know, it's a little bit of both. And I think this is helping us to understand what your key concerns are. You know, if parking is a key concern, it's almost like the, is there anything that we should make sure that we are really cognizant of, where we don't want to make any changes to parking, or open space should always be, you know, paramount. But I think I've heard so far that, you know, there's flexibility among all of these pieces, and you know, that this process is really just kind of helpful for me to understand where are you coming from? And when you look at a building, what do you see as the most important parts?
Sure. Mayor Pro Tem Newsom.
So as I look at some of these, you're asking us to do a more daunting task than maybe if we looked at it and said, when I look at it, there's at least two I don't think are as important to me as the others. And so I don't know if it's a matter of elimination, but when I look at it, relationship to street, we don't have any conformity on any one street. So I think that one's less of, it's not number one. Orientation and frontage, I'm not the architect on this council, so it doesn't really matter to me as long as it has a front door or a back door and it looks like it's, you know, meeting the requirements of affordable, it's flexible. That's a homeowner decision, I think. So looking at that, those are the two that don't matter the most to me. Materials, open space, landscaping seem to be one and the same. Just because you can use materials with trees and stuff to be part of materials in my mind. Parking, you know, there's that give and take of what are you giving up, what are you gaining. Depends on where you are in town. Some properties have more parking than others. So those would be the four that I think that could flex for me.
Yeah.
Councilmember Borbo.
Yes, thank you. I kind of look at the setbacks, the massing, and roof forms. I'm going to cheat. I'm going to say those are all one. Because they're...
Excellent. Keep going. Make it make it three total.
Because, especially the massing and the articulation roof forms, because they affect each other. And in reality, so does the setbacks. For me, the only other one, though, that I think is critical probably is the circulation / parking. A lot of these are not going to be big enough. A lot of these lots we're talking about are not going to be big enough to have any kind of internal circulation to speak of. And so the parking is an important thing because we still live in a car-oriented society, and even if we convert to electric vehicles, our until the magic bus of some sort comes along, if we don't think about parking, we're going to have a lot of neighbors and neighborhoods with, parking issues, parking fights, et cetera. So I think you can't escape the importance of circulation and parking. But I think, like Mayor Pro Tem Newsom said, the orientation, frontage, relationship to the street, our properties and stuff are so unique and different. I don't see that trying to set a standard there. And for me, materials... I don't want to dictate to people what they're going to use for materials. And the same with landscaping is very important to me, but I can live without that if we're limited in numbers.
All right. Councilmember Funk, followed by Councilmember Darris.
Thank you, Madam Mayor. I'm much in concurrence here that orientation, frontage, and relationship to the street are things that we can set aside, particularly because we have a lot of lots in this section of, that where this these policies will be applicable. We've got a lot of really deep lots, so that means that presence to the street is less of a big factor. It also means, again, with what Councilmember Ribot is saying, we've got to get the parking right. If you don't, we may need to allow for flexibility for different proposed usages. So you have something that is going to be deed restricted to older people who, like a property that Haslow has where they're serving developmentally disabled adults who predominantly don't drive. So parking's not such an issue. I don't know what other communities are doing about this, but if there's a way to allow for some flexibility in the standards based on who's going to be occupying the property, or the group it's at least designed to be occupied for, I think that would be helpful. That parking is, if we don't get the parking right, the place becomes unlivable. It's a stress every single day that you can't, you're afraid to go out and get your kid from junior high because if you come back, you're going to have lost your parking space and you're going to be circulating around your neighborhood looking for what you could do and you can't deal with kids or elderly parents or any of those things in life or can't even unload your groceries. We have to make these places livable and pleasant, and that means we've got to get the parking right. Roof forms we can be a lot more flexible on. I do want to see articulation on the vertical articulation because that's, to me, the issue is we don't want it to look industrial. And if you've got enough articulation, then in my mind, it doesn't look like a factory. Massing, I'm less concerned that we stair step things back, tier things, higher floors back, but that we have some things that break the visual plane of a wall. So if you've got windows or balconies or those kinds of things, then you don't have to necessarily stair-step back and lose all of that square-footed space. Massing is more really about height for me and how it's relating. If we get the transitions right, we can allow for the massing that we need. So I think that, and in terms of open space, I want to distinguish between outdoor gathering space, which can be very small, but is essential to it feeling like community, just a little bit of breathing space. And the kinds of open space requirements that we have that are more like everybody's got to have some semblance of suburban lawn. No, everybody doesn't have to have suburban lawn. But a small outdoor space that where you can have connections, that can be defined in some functional way that is not large, and we can be more flexible in the way that open space is allowed, particularly in neighborhoods where you've got walkability to parks and other open space. I'd leave flexibility on materials to the discretion of the project. I think we can do that without it looking industrial. And then what's the first one up there? Oh, setbacks, yeah. Setbacks are about dealing with appropriate transitions, so we need to be allow some flexibility there, but be attentive to how these spaces will interact with other spaces nearby so that the collective effect is a good place to grow up in.
Complete. Thank you. Councilmember Darris.
Thank you. Okay, most of the stuff's already been touched on.
So you can just say ditto, and we're good.
Yeah. No. I mean, I think I got some good notes, but I can go through this fairly quickly, kind of make it quick here. So on these items, I've kind of clustered them into essentially three different groups here. The relationship to the street, articulation, orientation, and materials, I see all of those things going towards the quality of the project. Now, everybody wants, you know, again, that also goes to the quality of living, but because nobody wants to live in an ugly building or in an ugly neighborhood or anything like that. So, but that to me is the quality of the project. And I think it's important. I think there's things that we can apply to that to make sure that we can achieve a good quality project. As we've done in the past on a number of projects, we have what we require as in a CUP is high quality architecture. Okay, and I think that sometimes it's how do you achieve that? It's a personal thing, but I think that anyway, that's my feeling on those things. On the setbacks and massing, I put those two together. That has to do with, I feel, more of the transition type things. Setbacks and massing I see as makes for good neighbors. Okay, so we're talking about how is this going to relate to the existing neighborhood that's been there for a while. In some areas it might be less important, but I think that's to me where that mostly applies. The quality of living is where I'm mostly focused on a lot of this stuff, is parking, open space, and the sight lines. I think parking is extremely important. You know, with the cost of living that we have, you know, there was a time when a family can have one car. You know, it's mom and dad and a couple of kids and it's one car. Well, now it's mom and dad, they both work, they both need a car. So really limiting the parking becomes a serious problem. That's why I think parking is so important. I also think the outdoor open space is also important. I know what you had said, Mayor, about, you know, I can take my kids to the park. Well, are you really going to do that every single day? I mean, sometimes the kids want to just go outside and play. And I think to be able to have even a small place, some place where they can go outside and be safe and enjoy the outdoors, I think is important. So I think open space is one of my important ones. And sightline really isn't on here. I'm not exactly sure where that would necessarily be. Sightline. So it's like the private space, you know, so you're not peering down into somebody's backyard or somebody's peering into your space, whatever. But I think to be able to have your private space, even though you're in a higher density architecture or higher density living area, to be able to feel like you're in your own private space without feeling like you're being watched or somebody feels like you're watching them, I think is important. So community space, as I mentioned, or the open space could be a community space or an individual space, depending on the number of units that we're talking about. Like I mentioned earlier, if it's four or five units on a piece of property, they might be able to have their own individual yard, whether it's fenced in or not. If it's a higher density, then at least something where people can gather and enjoy the outdoors. So I think that's what I've got for now. Thank you.
Okay. I think that we went much further into detail than you probably wanted us to this evening. But it's our only item, and so we felt that we had the liberty to do that. So apologies to staff, but that's what we did tonight. And it's something that obviously we're very interested in, and it's a big thing, and we want to get it right. And I think what you've heard from listening to all of us is that it's very hard to make choices here, is that, you know, the four of us who aren't architects are like, oh, orientation, frontage, relation to the street. And then I hear the architect to say, oh, high quality design means orientation, frontage, relationship to the street, articulation, and materials. And I'm like, okay, let's go with those. Because we do want those nice, without saying, you know, you have to, so how do you do that? How do you have that high quality? How do you make those objective design standards? Because, you know, to me, that is important. The setbacks and the massing, as has been said, is part of that transitions. The circulation and the parking. I can't choose three of these and say the other five really aren't that important. When it comes to the circulation, I'm wondering, one of the things that you mentioned, Director, is that the state is allowing covered parking to be turned into ADUs, which could then completely subvert any type of parking that we set up. So I think we need to look at that. Do we just look at non-covered parking throughout? And I know that that doesn't give people, you know, shading or all of that, but if it prevents that from being turned into ADUs and then taking away parking but adding people and making a worse parking problem, I think that's something that we need to consider. So Genevieve, Director Dunsmore, have we not honed in enough, or are you getting a real sense of what we're trying to do and you know how to take a next step from what we've said tonight?
I appreciate, I think, the feedback we've gotten. I really like the discussion. So I'm going to have Genevieve weigh in, but I'm glad you got into a deeper level. Okay. And I think, yeah, you've grasped a lot of what we've been struggling with, so this is good.
I would absolutely agree with that. I think that it's reinforced some of the directions that where we've kind of started thinking through and honed in on a couple of things that we want to make sure and are careful about. So I it's been really useful for me. So thank you very much.
Okay, good. Well, wonderful. With that said, I think we have completed this item, and we will move on to council announcements and committee reports. Genevieve, thank you so much for being here and for just a really a thorough report and a lot of things for us to really look at and be able to grasp. So thank you to you and Phil. You did a really nice job tonight.
Thanks for having me.
All right, so council announcements and committee reports. I will go from my right to my left, so start with Councilmember Funk.
Okay, the Tascadero Basin Groundwater Sustainability Agency, say it three times in a row fast, is going to be meeting on the 20th at 4:30. This should be a fairly short meeting, and it will be a combination of in-person and Zoom. I think we have to just, it's relatively routine business on this one. The Design Review Committee is not meeting this week. And the Homeless Services Oversight Council is meeting on the 20th, and this will be our big discussion as we're observing feedback that's come on the draft countywide strategic plan to address homelessness, where the agenda item will be to approve that plan with amendments as necessary and send it on to the Board of Supervisors for their approval also. In part of my HSOC hat, I'll be presenting to the Paso Robles City Council on the 19th, presented to Downtown SLO this morning, and did a webinar with Mr. Dvoznik, and former Senator Blakeslee, and Mr. Gillette with the League of Women Voters on Monday.
Thank you. Mayor Pro Tem Newsom.
Nothing to report.
Councilmember Bourbeau.
Yes, thank you. The Integrated Waste Management Authority Board will meet tomorrow. The item of significance to report is that all seven cities have ratified the Joint Powers Amendment, and so that is in effect, and a significant majority of the community services districts as well have ratified it. A few still have to do so, but they're doing so. Is not as important as the cities, because all seven cities needed to ratify for it to be in effect. So it is, and so that's a major step forward.
Excellent. And Councilmember Darris.
I have nothing to report.
All right. And July is a very quiet month for most things. I'll have a countywide mayor's meeting this Friday in Grover Beach, so which means I'll have to take a sweater or a jacket with me. As I leave 95-degree weather and probably go down to something that's 60-ish. So anyway, looking forward to that. And with that, I will ask if there are any individual determinations or actions. Looking at my camera. Seeing none? All right. Meeting adjourned.